From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
How much will change in Washington, and how much will stay the same? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Democratic victories are creating a host of expectations about the next Congress, especially when it comes to Iraq. But the old Republican Congress still has work to do, not the least the passage of spending bills to keep the government going. On To the Point, President Bush also wants warrantless wiretaps, an energy bill, and nuclear technology for India. We'll hear about his chances. We'll also look at the options for changing the course in Iraq, including regional diplomacy with Syria and Iran. On Reporter's Notebook later on, in California, Arnold Schwarzenegger bucks the Democratic tide. How did he do it? First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Marvin Alney, back with To the Point. As the old Congress makes way for the new, President Bush says he's open to any ideas for changing the course in Iraq. On To the Point, we'll look at the options and what might be expected from Donald Rumsfeld's replacement, Robert Gates. What about diplomacy with Syria and Iran? On Reporter's Notebook, Arnold Schwarzenegger and bipartisanship in California. First, this news update. President Bush lunched at the White House today with Speaker-elect Nancy Pelosi. They pledged mutual cooperation once again when the Democrats take over next year. Earlier, with his cabinet standing behind him, the president outlined what he wants from the old Republican Congress when it convenes its lame duck session next week.
Another important priority in the war on terror is for the Congress to pass the Terrorist Surveillance Act. We also need to pass the bipartisan energy legislation that's now before Congress. And on the foreign policy front, we need to complete the work on legislation that will allow us to cooperate with India on civilian nuclear technology.
President Bush at the White House today. Ron Hutchison is White House correspondent for the McClatchy Newspapers. Ron, good to have you with us.
Hi, Warren. How are you?
Good. The president's talking cooperation, but as far as those issues that he just listed are concerned, that sounds more like a challenge to the Democrats than a call for cooperation.
Yeah, that's a little off message here where everything is sweetness and light, but I don't think he's too serious about it. I don't see how you can get the eavesdropping program through this Congress, or the next one for that matter, without some modification. But there are some items. You know, first of all, this Congress has got a lot on its plate, just keeping the government in business. They've got like 10, I think it is, spending bills to finish. The government's operating. Most of the government is operating on one of those stopgap funding measures, and we remember what happened the last time. There was big trouble about that, and the government shut down for a while. Nobody's going to want that in this new climate.
When the president, though, comes out as he did, with the whole cabinet standing behind him, pledging cooperation with the new leadership and so on, and talks about, again, as you mentioned, the wireless wiretapping, the energy legislation, the granting of nuclear technology to India, does he hope to sneak those things by while the Republicans still have the majority?
Well, I think they can get the India deal. Actually, Reid is on the record in favor of doing that one. So I think they can
Harry
get
Reid,
that.
Harry Reid, the Democratic leader from Nevada. Go ahead.
Correct. And he's ready to do it even in this lame duck session. So that one is not as controversial. I am not sure what the president is talking about with the energy legislation. There is a bill that's out there that's probably going to go through without much trouble that he might be referring to when he talks about energy, because it's in line with what he wants to do, which would permit drilling in the Gulf of Mexico, south of the Florida Panhandle. That kind of thing could go through, but we're not going to talk about, you're not going to get the big energy package. The surveillance program is a different issue. That one got bottled up in the Republican-controlled Senate, and there's no reason to think that the Republican-controlled Senate is going to be any more excited about that in this lame duck session.
All right. We're talking with Ron Hutchison, the White House correspondent for the McClatchy Newspapers. Well, what then is the White House doing, do you think, by laying out this agenda? There's also been some talk they might try to get the Senate committee to, or the whole Senate, to confirm Ambassador Bolton at the United Nations. Are they really going to try to push for these kinds of goals? Or, as you say, is this in some way not really serious?
Well, that's the big question in Washington now is which Bush are we going to see now that he's taken what he called a thumping in the election? you know, remember, he was a uniter before he was a divider, so he might want to go back to being a uniter again, or it might just be some post-election blather, and we'll go back to battle, you know, pretty quickly here. I expect that the president does not want to pick a fight this quickly, even if he is looking for combat down the road. It's just too soon after this election and these conciliatory moves by both parties. And frankly, the Democrats aren't going to be looking for big fights in this lame duck session. I think in general, everybody's going to say, let's just get through this and head into the holidays in December, and we'll come back in January and see how things are.
Is the president, as the second term begins to come to an end, if that's the right way to put it, thinking legacy?
Absolutely. He's got to be. And you know, I was just talking to one of his old friends in Texas today who was saying he doesn't think the president wants a legacy of failure these final 2 years. So that does argue for trying to find some sort of middle ground where both sides can claim accomplishment. Of course, now there's a lot of kinds of pressures working against that, but I think at this stage he's obviously thinking about his legacy.
Is he thinking at all about who his successor might be?
Absolutely. I'm sure he is on that, too, because it's pretty clear that this Iraq war won't be over by then, and that's going to shape his legacy. Let's face it. He rolled the dice on that one, and if it carries over into the next presidency, that'll be a big deal. You know, if the next person says, okay, we've had enough of this and we're out of there, that will definitely shape the president's legacy.
All right. A lot at stake for the president as the last part of the second term begins. And the big question, as Ron Hutchison just put it, which Bush are we going to see, the uniter or the divider? Ron Hutchison, as always, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
White House correspondent to the McClatchy newspapers. In a moment, how much will change in Washington and how much will stay the same? On To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warman Olney back with To the Point. Once again, President Bush has laid out his agenda for the lame duck session of the Republican Congress that begins next week. Gail Russell Chadwick covers Congress for the Christian Science Monitor. Always good to have you on our program.
Good to be with you.
We should point out that Conrad Burns, the senator from Montana, Republican, has now conceded defeat to John Tester, so there will be a Democrat in that seat. That leaves Senator Allen of Virginia, who has not yet conceded, and there is, however, some prediction that he will do so within the next few minutes. Gail, do you have any sense of where Senator Allen's going to go?
Oh, I think the rumors are that he will simply concede. A recount in Virginia isn't what we all remember, where you go through the paper ballots and discover, you know, 300 here or there. They had one for attorney general, and I think they only scared up about 27 votes one way or the other, far short of what he would need to actually change the outcome here. There's also talk of, you know, whether he really wants to put the state and the country and the Senate through at least 3 or 4 more weeks of waiting to see how this turns out. But, you know, the Democrats, as soon as I finish this show, I'm dashing up to Capitol Hill, where the Democrats on the Senate side are celebrating their control of the Senate. So someone has already decided that it's over. But Republicans are not conceding it yet.
Very quickly, I want to get on to discussion about the options in Iraq, and then we'll come back, talk further about the Congress. But Gail Russell Chadwick, what about this list of goals that the president laid out today for the current Congress when it comes back on Monday? Of course, it has to pass appropriations bills. That's the major piece of business. The president mentioned that. But then, as we heard earlier, he also talked about the Terrorist Surveillance Act, about energy legislation, and giving civilian nuclear technology to India. Are those things that he's likely to get action on, even with the Republicans still in charge?
I'd be astonished. Perhaps with India, as your previous speaker said, Harry Reid does support that. But, you know, everybody's mind is on the future here. I think what's going to happen next week is they'll just pass a continuing resolution for all of those appropriation bills, I think 11 out of 13. which they'll take up the first week of December in some sort of omnibus bill, which is the, a nightmare on Capitol Hill. Everything gets thrown into them. People end up voting at midnight, having no idea what they're voting for. Omnibus bills are a nasty business, but that looks like how this session is going to end. All thought is really toward the next year, and I'd be astonished if anything like terrorist surveillance or certainly not energy legislation gets taken up in this climate. Why would Democrats do it? They come back in January with many more votes.
And with Speaker Hastert saying he will not try to be a leader of the minority Republicans in the new Congress, one would assume that even in this existing Congress next week and in the weeks beyond, the Republicans probably will be very much concentrated on who's going to lead their party.
Exactly. That's going to be a very interesting fight. Looking like it's shaping up between John Boehner, who's the current majority leader, and Mike Pence, very interesting figure in the Republican Party. He's the head of the Republican Study Group, the main conservative caucus, really feels that the reason the Republicans lost the election is that they got away from Ronald Reagan, and the way back is a kind of bridge to the past, which is what he represents. Let's get back to what we stood for before, small government, fiscal conservatism, and so forth. And the last figure would be Joe Barton, who's the energy chairman. It's going to be a very interesting race, and in a way tell you a lot about where Republicans are headed.
And on the Democratic side, of course, there is a fight to be a majority leader. We know that Nancy Pelosi will be the speaker. John Murtha is challenging Steny Hoyer of Maryland. That, of course, will raise the issue of Iraq. And I want to talk further with you about that, Gail Russell Chaddock, in just a few minutes. First, though, let's hear what the president said today. Yesterday, of course, he said that Donald Rumsfeld's replacement, Robert Gates, would bring a new perspective to the war in Iraq. In his brief appearance today at the White House, he said this.
I'm open to any idea or suggestion that will help us achieve our goals of defeating the terrorists and ensuring that Iraq's democratic government succeeds.
Again, the president today. James Dobbins is former ambassador. He's now director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at the RAND Corporation, special former envoy for Afghanistan immediately after 9/11, author of the two-volume RAND History of Nation Building. Ambassador Dobbins, good to have you back on our program.
Thank you. Pleasure.
When the president says that he is open to new ideas, what sorts of new ideas do you think he's going to get, particularly from Robert Gates?
Well, I think that there are possibilities for change at three levels, the diplomatic level, the political level, and the military. Most of the debate in the United States and attention is focused on the third of those, with a somewhat artificial binary choice between stay the course and cut and run, whereas, in fact, there are any number of alternatives between keeping 140,000 troops there and none at all. But personally, I think that the diplomatic and political initiatives are the ones that should take precedence, and changes in the military posture should flow from what we can achieve or fail to achieve in those realms.
All right. The president, let's talk about politics. First of all, the president said he wants to see the democratic regime in Iraq maintained. Is that likely to come into question, particularly when the Iraq Study Group, led by James Baker and Lee Hamilton, former Secretary of State, former Democratic congressman, reports, which will happen very soon?
Well, I don't think anybody, I don't know of anybody who's advocating that we should cease to support the duly elected government in Iraq or throw our support to a strongman or some alternative. I don't think those options are really open to us. I do think there are a number of people who believe that the administration's almost exclusive focus on regional democratization as the solution for the Middle East problems as a whole is exaggerated, and that we ought to be de-emphasizing regime change and democratization in the region and begin emphasizing concepts like Iraq's stability, territorial integrity, sovereignty, and unity. Those are concepts upon which you can get a regional consensus, upon which neighboring states are likely to agree, whereas they're not likely to agree on a concept which says that first Iraq is democratized and then they have to change their own form of government.
When you talk regional diplomacy, that, of course, brings up the question of Syria and Iran. Should we or should we not begin to negotiate with them? Secretary Baker has indicated fairly recently that he's warmed to that idea. What do you think?
I think it's essential that you talk to all the neighbors. They simply have too much influence and too much at stake to be ignored, and I think it's particularly important that you talk to the ones that are least helpful. I think if you look back to 1995 and how did we solve the civil war in Bosnia, we brought in Milosevic and Tudjman, the presidents of Serbia and Croatia, the two men who were personally guilty of genocide. We brought them to the Dayton Peace Conference. We got them to be part of the solution, and we got their help in implementing that solution. In 1999, who did we turn to try to broker a ceasefire and end to the Kosovo War? We asked the Russians to broker the ceasefire because the Russians were supporting our enemy. And in 2001, how did we bring about a rapid evolution to a moderate government in Afghanistan? We brought in the countries that had been fomenting civil war in Afghanistan for 20 years. Pakistan, Iran, India, and Russia, brought them to the table and got their help in bringing about a transition to a moderate government in Afghanistan. You simply need, neighbors have too much influence to be ignored, and you need their cooperation, and if you can't get it, then you probably cannot succeed in stabilizing a failing state.
Again, former Ambassador James Dobbins, personally involved in some of those negotiations in the Balkans and Afghanistan as well. Let me ask you to stay with us, if you will. I want to introduce a member of one of the advisory committees of the Iraq Study Group. He is Ruel Marc Gerecht, resident at the American Enterprise Institute, a conservative think tank in Washington, a contributing editor to the Weekly Standard. Always good to have you on our program.
My pleasure.
One of your colleagues at the American Enterprise Institute wrote in the Weekly Standard that he was leaving one of the advisory committees of the Iraq Study Group because he felt that it had been gerrymandered, as he put it, for predetermined recommendations, and that he was an example of token diversity. The predetermined recommendations, as he lines them out, sound very much like what we just heard from Ambassador Dobbins. What do you think about those alternatives, and where do you think the Iraq Study Group is going to go?
Well, I suspect the study group will go sort of in the direction that Jim has outlined. I don't think the Iraq Study Group is going to be very important. I think it's going to tank fairly quickly. I think the recommendations that will go forward once you get into the mechanics of it will be seen as not being terribly appealing. I don't think the president will go for it. I think it will bomb fairly quickly, and I actually think that's probably a good thing. Once it does bomb, I think the Bush administration will finally get serious about Iraq, and you will see, I think, one of two choices. I mean, that's actually, there could be three choices. I mean, the striking thing about the president has been, I think, a realization that has been in the White House for some time that the strategy that they have been following hasn't worked, but an unwillingness to go in a different direction, particularly to go in a direction that Mr. Rumsfeld and the most important general involved, John Abizaid, has refused to go, and that is surging more troops into Iraq, and particularly in Baghdad, and trying to get a hold of the situation. I think we will get down to a choice, and I think the other ones actually fall away. I would disagree strongly with Jim here, that you will either decide that you are going to leave Iraq, and if you do so, you need to do so completely and tout suite, or you will stay, surge troops in, and fight. It is difficult now to say which way the president will go. I don't think the president is capable personally of saying, I'm going to abandon Iraq. He just won't do it. I don't think he's going to agree to any type of troop reductions, because essentially what you're arguing is a Rumsfeldian position. That is, we can do more with less. I don't think that's likely. Whether he's willing to insert more troops, that we'll have to see. But I think the Iraq Survey Group is pretty overrated, and its effect will be small. I would love to see Jim go to Tehran and negotiate with Iranians. I don't think the Iranians will be cooperative there. I think they have a strong interest to see America bleed in Iraq. I think they are very much in favor of seeing the Shia community in Iraq radicalize even further. I don't think they're scared of instability in the country. I think that's also true, by the way, of the Syrians. And it is unlikely, I mean, if you look back at the Clinton administration, I mean, they bent over backwards, foreign policy through apologia to try to get the Iranians to deal with them. And that was under the presidency of Mohammad Khatami, who many people see as being a moderate. It is very unlikely that you're going to get a sympathetic treatment from President Ahmadinejad and from the ruler of the country, Ayatollah Khamenei.
Reuel Marc-Gerecht, once again at the Enterprise, American Enterprise Institute, the Weekly Standard, formerly also with the CIA, now on the advisory committee to the Iraq Study Group. Let me go back to former Ambassador Dobbins. Reuel Marc-Gerecht, even though he's on the advisory group, says the Iraq Study Group is going to tank pretty soon. What do you think?
I think that there's a brief period, a brief window of opportunity in the aftermath of the current election for a bipartisan approach, and I think the Iraq Study Group offers an excuse if the president wants to embrace that.
An excuse for what? What do you mean by that?
For embracing a bipartisan approach.
Mm-hmm.
It's made up of serious, well-considered individuals. The leadership is very prestigious. It is bipartisan. If it comes forward with proposals that have full support from its membership, I think it'll be taken seriously. I think Reuel is right that there isn't a silver bullet here. There's no secret solution that nobody's thought of that suddenly Jim Baker is going to come forward with. And there certainly is no assurance that a broader diplomatic effort in the region will yield significant results. On the other hand, it's certainly worth trying. It's worked before in the past. It can't possibly make things worse, and it may be able to ameliorate the situation. I don't agree with Reuel that there's a binary choice. You either have to put more troops in or get out entirely. I think there are other options. Personally, I would favor moving toward a smaller American presence made up largely of advisors and enablers, leaving the patrolling and the street fighting to the Iraqi forces, and largely removing American maneuver units from the country. I think that we're going to have to stay engaged in Iraq for years to come. I think our presence is so unpopular in Iraq and in the United States that maintaining current levels simply can't be sustained politically at either end of the spectrum, that is in Iraq or the United States, let alone increasing them. And we need to look for a sustainable level. I accept there are risks and costs associated with such an effort. The risk is that the place will collapse into total chaos, and that's a real risk. And the cost is that there'll probably be an increase in sectarian violence and will be associated with a regime which will in turn be associated with a number of abuses. But I think that those costs and risks are worth accepting, because I think that the alternatives of either escalating our engagement, which I think is unrealistic, or leaving entirely are even worse.
Again, former Ambassador James Dobbins. We'll come back in a moment. I want to ask Reuel Marc-Gerecht very particularly about how the scenario he laid out could be sustained in the United States, especially after this election and with the new Congress that's coming in. A little later, we'll go back and talk more about the Congress and about the President Bush and what he thinks about his legacy. On Reporter's Notebook, how did Arnold Schwarzenegger buck the Democratic tide? We'll find out about that on To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from The Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with To the Point, talking today for the moment about the options available in Iraq. We've heard earlier Reuel Marc-Gerecht one of the advisory groups of the Iraq Study Group, say that he thinks the alternatives are to leave or to fight, and that means putting more weapons, more troops into Iraq. Said that trying to stay there with fewer troops is a Rumsfeldian idea, do less with less, as it were, or do more with less. That won't work. Former Ambassador James Dobbins says you couldn't sustain a greater commitment of troops and treasure in Iraq now, particularly after this last election. Reuel Marc-Gerecht, your response to that?
Well, I prefer to talk about Shiites and Sunnis than Americans. I would say that
Americans are the ones that have to pay, though, if you're going to send
true.
More troops.
I think one of the best things about the Democrats triumphing in the House, and it appears in the Senate, is that you will make them more responsible. I think that as the Democrats become more responsible, and granted, the Congress of the United States isn't directly responsible for foreign policy, but its influence through the purse is substantial. that you will see a sizable chunk of the Democratic Party and Congress not be terribly cracked up about the idea of reducing forces, particularly if, and I think this is where Jim and I differ, I don't think you get any decent interval here. I think the notion of drawing down forces is going to quickly cause a collapse of the Iraqi army into Shiite and Sunni militias, and that you will be very quickly confronted with the choice of either watching this all go to hell, and we're not even close to that now, or trying to rescue the situation. And the longer you wait, of course, the worse it becomes. So I'm not convinced that if you had the proper leadership here, that the Americans would not sustain a greater effort. I think one of the certainly legitimate complaints and criticisms against the Bush administration is that its Iraq policy hasn't made much sense. I mean, there are a lot of people out there, I think, who on many other issues would agree more or less with the Republican Party. Yet on the Iraq issue, they've been confounded because if you look at what they have done since 2003, particularly if you look at the strategy and tactics of Secretary Rumsfeld and General Abizaid, which, by the way, have tried to do what Jim wants to do. I mean, they have all, including the president, have wanted to reduce forces in Iraq. The only thing that has kept them from doing that has been the realization on the ground, when they start to do that, things fall apart. I don't think that's going to change. You're not going to be able to do more with less.
All right. We're going to lose Ambassador Dobbins in a moment. I want to give him an opportunity to respond. All the talk since the election has been that we're going to see a change, and it's going to be in the direction that you suggested. What about Robert Gates? Where do you think he's likely to come down on all of this?
Well, Gates has been a member of the Iraq Study Group. Now, the Iraq Study Group are made up of eminent people who've listened to advice from a number of sources. They've listened to me, they've listened to Ruel, they've listened to a lot of other people. They've largely kept their own counsel. And other than what Jim Baker and Lee Hamilton have said publicly, nobody knows exactly where they're going to come out. On the other hand, Gates, like the others on the panel, have been for the last 6 months increasingly steeped in the options. They've been listening to people talk about Iraq. They've visited Iraq, and they've examined just about every idea that anybody has had for ameliorating the situation. So I think he comes to the position well equipped to think about the alternatives. I think that, you know, some of the objections that Ruel raises to moving in the direction that the American public largely have expressed themselves desirous of moving, that is to a smaller commitment, are well taken. There are, as I said, risks and costs, and he might well prove right. Nevertheless, the American presence in Iraq is wildly unpopular in Iraq itself. According to one opinion poll, 61% of all Iraqis approve of attacks on American forces, and that figure includes the Kurds, who are generally quite pro-American. And in the United States, the statistics on support for the war speak for themselves. So I do think that solutions that fly in the face of overwhelming public attitudes in both populations have an uphill climb.
All right. We're going to leave it at that for the moment. Former Ambassador James Dobbins, Ruel Mark Garak, thank you both very much for being with us.
Pleasure. Pleasure.
Let me go back to Gail Russell Chaddick. She's been listening to this conversation. She's the congressional reporter with the Christian Science Monitor. Earlier, Ruel Mark Garak said that the Democrats will become, as he put it, more responsible now that they're in leadership. They do, of course, have the power of the purse, as he pointed out. The all spending bills begin in the Congress. What about the expectations for the Democratic leadership when the new Congress convenes next year?
I think there's a very interesting issue for Democrats now. Until this point, it's been the president's war. But with leadership in both the House and the Senate, it is potentially now theirs as well. And there are real risks in that. Do you, for example, if you settle on some kind of phased withdrawal and things go south, even worse than they are right now, are Democrats responsible for that as well? I've been very interested with the way that both the president I just left a luncheon with Ken Melman, are framing this issue. They're saying, regardless of how you think we got to this point, we're all in this together, Democrats, Republicans, the whole country. We need to find a bipartisan policy that will prevent Iraq from becoming another Afghanistan. So it's a, you know, it leaves Democrats in a tough position because they are now involved in every decision that's made, for good or for ill.
All right. Once again, Gail Russell-Chadwick, congressional reporter with the Christian Science Monitor. Another contributor to our program who has been listening and not yet been heard from is Richard Schenkman. He's a presidential historian at George Mason University, editor of the website History News Network. Professor, good to have you on our program.
Glad to be here.
How do you think, given your studies of President Bush, he is now looking at this situation with 2 years left to go on his term? How do you interpret the things that he has said in the last few days, the replacement of Donald Rumsfeld with Robert Gates, or the attempted replacement, presuming that the Senate confirms? Where do you think the White House is really going to go?
I don't know where the White House is going to go. I would say that one of the pressures that President Bush won't publicly acknowledge, but that has got to be weighing on him, is that in 2 years, he has to wrap up the Iraq war one way or the other. Otherwise, he is dooming the Republican Party to failure in 08. He knows this. Karl Rove knows this. So that is playing a major role in making changes now. If he has to eat a compromise, I think he'll do it, knowing that 2 years from now, he can't leave this hanging. Harry Truman had the Korean War hanging, and of course, that cost the Democrats the presidency back in 52, and I think Bush and Rove are aware of this. So I think that's one of the important pressures. The thing that is shocking to me has been President Bush's stunning passivity over the last 3 years as the war has turned south. He hasn't replaced a single general. In fact, he always seems to leave the impression that he is giving the generals what they're doing. It's the generals' war. We've not had any previous president who's taken that kind of a passive approach. In the Civil War, when generals failed, Lincoln stepped in and he replaced them. And this is a pattern that presidents ever since have followed up to this president. And it's very, very interesting that now he's moving to get rid of Rumsfeld. Maybe he's realized that that passive approach just doesn't work.
He is replacing Rumsfeld, presuming again that the Senate approves, with Robert Gates, a man very much attached to the president's father, the first President Bush. What do you think is the significance of that?
Well, it does seem like we're getting a lot more of what the American people thought they were getting in 2000. You know, here was a man who had little experience and the thinnest resume of probably any president in history, except possibly for Jimmy Carter. And he comes into office and people are thinking, well, he's got that last name. So they felt assured that even though he had a thin resume, there was a certain comfortableness with him because of that last name. And yet we discovered that he wasn't trying to be like his father at all. He was trying to be the un-Bush Bush. Well, now it seems that in a period of terrible trouble, he's deciding, maybe I'm going to give the American people what they thought they were getting back in 2000.
Bob Woodward, in one of his books, his most recent book, says that the current president hung up on the former president at one point during a conversation about Iraq. What about the family dynamics? How important are they?
Well, I think that, you know, we tend to think of President Bush as a simple man. He's the guy who likes to go back to Crawford at the hottest period of the year and push around the sagebrush and chop down trees or something. He's got a very complicated emotional relationship with his father and his mother, and it's not recognized by the public because all they see is what he projects on television, which is just this most shallow of images. In fact, behind the scenes, of course, there's the complicated dynamic of him trying to outdo his father, him trying not to make the mistakes of his father, him also trying to please his father. And that's very, very complicated. And who knows how that psychological dynamic is actually playing on the choices that he makes. No one can know but him.
Richard Schenkman, a presidential historian, George Mason University, editor of the website History News Network. Back to Gail Russell Chadwick. You pointed out that the Democrats are going to have to assume a certain responsibility for this war because they will be in charge of the Congress. That's presuming, of course, that Senator Allen concedes, as it's widely expected, that he will. What powers really does the Congress have in this area? And suppose the Democrats decided they wanted to go in a completely different direction. We talked earlier about the power of the purse. What about the politics there? Could they use that?
Isn't that exactly the point? What Democrat wants to take a vote denying funds to troops in the field? You know, that is the kind of tribal memory of Democrats, in my sense, is what happened to Senator Nunn, who voted against the war. The first war in the Persian Gulf was a very prominent senator and a very viable presidential candidate, and his career vanished. And so ever since then, the sense of being weak on national defense is a really tough one. And even Democrats that oppose the war very strongly usually have a caveat, but no, we're not going to deny support to troops in the field. If the White House stands up on this and just refuses to budge in any direction, I was struck with what the Vice President said before the elections, that if he were subpoenaed, he might not even come, nor would the president. Of course, that's the other thing that a Democratic Congress can do, start issuing subpoenas. There were more than 1,000 of them issued from a Republican Congress to the Clinton White House. There have been zero issued to the Bush White House. That's going to change. But if it comes right down to it, you've got the subpoenas and the embarrassing hearings, but the only thing that matters is the money. And will Democrats be able to pull themselves together if it comes to this and say, we're not funding troops in the field?
Yeah, that's pretty unusual or unlikely, is it not? Particularly given the fact that in the Congress, the Democrats who are new to the Congress, the freshmen, are in many cases much more conservative than the liberal leadership who will be
that's
taking
right.
over the committee. So they might be able to, they might want to do something, but they couldn't get the votes in their own caucus.
That's right. You know, the other thing, I think back to my teaching days, the number of students I had who had no idea that Democrats had started the Vietnam War. They were convinced that it was Nixon's war. You know, these wars that get started by one party, it is very interesting how they can migrate to the other, and I am sure that's on the mind of Democrats as well. They see a mandate from the voters to do something about this war, but they certainly don't want to own it.
So, Richard Schenkman, back to you, a professor at George Mason. You said earlier that the president doesn't want to leave things hanging. On the other hand, there are those who say that we'll have to be in Iraq for many years to come. Does the president, do you think, have the option here of, in some way, trying to pass it on to the Democrats?
Well, I think that, in fact, if things go south and Democrats start taking moves to extract us from Iraq in such a way and in such a public and dramatic way that the president can turn around and say he's demoralizing our troops, I mean that the Democrats are demoralizing our troops and they're demoralizing the Iraqi government and blame the Democrats in Congress, I think he'll do that. This is what Republicans have done ever since the fall of Vietnam. It was always a blame game of who lost Vietnam. Well, even though you had a Republican president at the time, you had a Democratic Congress, and the Republicans said it was the Democratic Congress which lost Vietnam. Now, at that time, we didn't have troops in the field, and they cut off most of the funding to South Vietnam, but that was enough. That was enough to have the Republicans make that charge, and I think that President Bush would be tempted to make that same charge.
What about the prospect then, Professor, of President Bush deciding, as he has said, to get along with the Democrats and really try to work out a bipartisan solution? He has been the most partisan of presidents. Earlier it was pointed out that he has been more a divider than a uniter. I think before you both of you came on the air, we heard from our earlier reporter at the White House that we don't really know which Bush we're going to see. He was, of course, a uniter in Texas, but he's been much more of a divider politically as president. Professor Shankman, which Bush do you think we're going to see?
Well, it's an interesting question, isn't it, that we have these two different Bushes, Governor Bush and President Bush, and they had two entirely different styles. At this point, it'd be very hard for him to change stripes. I don't know of another president who, midway or toward the end of his term, would have changed stripes in as dramatic a way as President Bush would be required to if he suddenly became this bipartisan leader. He would lose his authenticity. People wouldn't be sure who he was. I think that would weaken him with his own base. And really, without that base, he's got nothing. He's got that lock on that 40% base, and by gosh, he cannot jettison them. He can't damage them in any way.
All right. Well, obviously, a great deal at stake at both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue, and we will see what obviously probably sooner rather than later what the patterns are going to be. Richard Shankman, thanks to you, presidential historian, George Mason University, editor of the website History News Network, and Gail Russell Chaddick, congressional reporter with the Christian Science Monitor. Thanks, both of you, for being with us today.
Thank you.
The Democrats picked up six governorships from Republicans this week, including Ohio, Maryland, Massachusetts, and New York. They now have a majority of governors for the first time since 1994. They did not take California, even though the biggest state in the union is increasingly blue. In a moment, we'll talk about the political comeback of another political giant, Arnold Schwarzenegger, on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to podcast this program, visit kcrw.com and click on KCRW A to Z.
We're only back with Popoter's Notebook on To the Point. A year ago, Arnold Schwarzenegger took a political bath when a series of propositions lost big with California voters. But this week, he won re-election with almost 60% of the vote. In addition, a package of public works bonds worth more than $40 billion also passed, despite the fact that California is running a multi-billion dollar deficit. Joe Matthews is a reporter for the Los Angeles Times. He's author of The People's Machine, Arnold Schwarzenegger and the Rise of Blockbuster Democracy. Joe Matthews, good to have you on our program.
It's a pleasure. Thanks very much.
Love your title. This series of bonds, the $40 billion bonds, several initiatives all combined that passed, were put on the ballot with the governor and the Democrats in the legislature, the ones who lead it and have the majorities in California. The governor now is talking about bipartisanship and says that's what won the election for him. Describe his sense of bipartisanship as you see it.
Wow. I think his sense of bipartisanship has changed. At first, it was a sort of aggressive, on the offense, sort of centrist populist idea. And I think this year it's largely been finding things in the Democratic program that interest him and then finding compromises on the Democratic priorities that he can live with. That's essentially what he's done this year. It's a sort of strategic surrender to the Democrats, but sold in this way as of the new Arnold, or as his people have been selling it for the last 48 hours, the Arnold model, and that this is the way people can govern across the country. I think, you know, that's a very interesting theory. I'm not sure it works unless you're an international celebrity.
Well, that of course, is an important fact with Arnold Schwarzenegger, as you suggest in your book, The Rise of Blockbuster Democracy isn't possible if you don't have a blockbuster to do it. But what does the future hold in Sacramento? The governor says he wants to deal now with health care, with prison reform, with water, which is, of course, the significant, most important issue historically in the state of California, all potentially very controversial issues.
Well, I think this is the real test. The test is whether this, what he's done this year, which is essentially give in to Democrats and support Democratic priorities, but, you know, really, you know, cooperate and work together and look for areas of agreement, whether now with this mandate he can do the same kind of cooperation and maybe give in a bit, but be doing it on issues that are more center priorities or in some cases have been conservative priorities. I think they'll get into, you know, greater accountability in education, particularly for teachers, which likely will be opposed by the California Teachers Association. You could get into the pension issue, which is becoming sort of another third rail of politics. But the idea is, I mean, what his argument is that what he's done this year, besides just getting him reelected, has tried to sort of build a base of trust. He's telling Democrats, I'm trying to work with you. I'm not going to trying to hurt you. I really want to help, you know, your priorities when it works for me. But I think the question is, will there be honest compromise when the priorities are not Democratic issues?
Joe Matthews, once again, the staff writer for the LA Times, author of The People's Machine, Arnold Schwarzenegger and the Rise of Blockbuster Democracy. You said earlier that some of the people around the governor, some of whom came from the Bush administration, Bush campaigns,
sure.
and he drew from that source, are talking about how this might be a model for the country. The question then becomes, to what extent did his mandate, almost 60% of the vote, how much of it was really due to the fact that even though he's been governor now for a couple of years, he really is a celebrity for very other reasons, very different reasons than just from being a politician?
I think a lot of his victory and mandate comes from that celebrity. Now, he's a very smart guy who really knows how to use that celebrity. To go back to the beginning of your question, I think the people who've come out and worked for him, I mean, there are a lot of Democrats, but also folks who've worked for President Bush and Vice President Cheney, but they tend to be, in the sense, I mean, they work for their client. And, you know, Matt Dowd, who's the chief political consultant and been the strategist behind a lot of this, is a former Democrat. So I think this does seem to be, things they're saying does seem to be heartfelt. I think the question of, you know, sort of in the long term of whether he's really a model, I think it's, the problem is his celebrity gives him this enormous advantage. It doesn't work just in seducing Democratic legislators, which, you know, people, you often hear that commentary, but also it's kept the Republican Party in line in the state. You know, Republican legislators haven't given him many votes on budgets and other big legislative initiatives of his. But he's, you know, he's so darn charming. He helps the party raise more money than it otherwise could. It's helped with the infrastructure. And the fact that, the, you know, sort of the only issue he's really given them is consistently his taxes and to a lesser extent sort of the driver's license issue for people who are undocumented immigrants. You know, he's just likable, and that helps. I mean, you might not need to be a celebrity to follow the Arnold model, but you'd have to have some sort of independent standing and a considerable amount of charm to pull it off.
You sound like you had earlier, though, you have your doubts about whether a blockbuster democracy Schwarzenegger style can be useful as a model elsewhere in the nation. What are your doubts about?
Well, no, I mean, what I mean by blockbuster democracy is not necessarily, you know, Schwarzenegger's own that. That's my attempt to rename the term direct democracy, you know, initiatives, referendums, and recall, because they're so indirect. You know, most of them don't get on the ballot. The ones that are on the ballot, most of them lose. And, in fact, most of the measures that actually pass end up never taking effect. They're either thrown out by the courts or otherwise subverted by people in the political process. That's what I mean by blockbuster democracy. And blockbuster democracy is growing everywhere, leaps and bounds across the country. I do think I am a skeptic of his sort of bipartisan peacemaking approach. I mean, ultimately, for that to work, he needs to get not only Democratic legislators who do want to build a record and solutions, but he's got to get entrenched interest groups, both on the right and the left, And I think, you know, those interest groups have dealt with Schwarzenegger, and there's a real issue of trust there. You know, particularly the California Teachers Association, which, you know, for my money, probably the most politically sophisticated interest group in the state, you know, had a deal with him, and which they liked, but then he ultimately walked away from. He sort of has restored the funding of it this year. But I think that experience, you know, even if this guy is offering a, you know, a deal that sounds very good and it and would advance the ball in an important matter of public policy, I think anyone making a deal with him is going to think back to some of the switching around he's done and wonder, you know, this sounds like a good thing, but will he really keep his word? I mean, that's the fundamental question for him. And I think he's got a lot to prove to people on that front.
What happens to him when his governorship comes to an end? He can't run for president under the Constitution because
right.
he wasn't born in this country. Is he going to try to be a national force of some kind?
Well, I think it's clear that he's going to be a national force of some kind. In the last week or so, his people have been sort of saying pointedly that he's not ruling out a run for Senate against Barbara Boxer in 2010. I have a really hard time seeing him do that. This is a person who is so profoundly impatient and, you know, and really has trouble with legislators of both parties.
Not right? made for the legislative
yeah,
process.
I think he wonders what they do all day. This is a person who works very long hours and is so efficient, gets so much done. I mean, not just in the gubernatorial aspect of his life, but in other aspects of his life. I just can't imagine him doing that. But, you know, the Constitution doesn't say anything about running for president. It just says he can't be president. And what I would my best guess of what he might do is he could take ballot initiatives and run multiple ballot initiatives on the same subjects that matter to him in multiple states. There are 24 states that have the initiative like California does.
And that would be, to use your term again, blockbuster democracy in a big way. That's all the time we have. Joe Matthews, thanks a lot for being with us.
My pleasure.
The People's Machine, Arnold Schwarzenegger, The Rise of Blockbuster Democracy. Today's program produced by Andrea Brody with Vanessa Romo and Karen Radziner. I'm Warman Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and PRI.
PRI, Public Radio International.